Welcome to this podcast for the Centre for Public Integrity, a podcast where we, Australia's leading democracy research institute, bring listeners with us as we examine the interlinking of democracy and integrity. I'm Quentin Dempster, a journalist, and today I'm speaking with Professor Gabriel Appleby. Gabriel has been a director of the Centre for Public Integrity for 2 years. Gabriel is one of Australia's leading constitutional law academics, and we're about to explore what motivates Gabriel in taking on this focus on integrity and democracy in our country, and of course with comparisons internationally. Welcome, Gabriel.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Quentin.
Could you share a bit about your early life so we get to know a little bit more about you and how you ended up in the law at first, before we get on to the vexed issue of integrity?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and it wasn't necessarily an anticipated path. I didn't know any lawyers. I didn't even really know what a lawyer did when I was growing up. My dad, when I was very young, was a professional clown. And after realizing that that wasn't going to bring in enough money, he became a public servant in the community arts sector. And so I grew up in a house in which public service and integrity in that sense was very strong, but not in a house in which law and lawyers were common. And I really grew up as a science and maths girl. I did science and maths all through high school, and I desperately wanted to be a vet. I wanted to look after animals. But it turns out that I can't stand the sight of blood. So I had to make a quick change in focus at the time when I needed to apply for university. And it was just one of those situations where I thought, well, hey, look, law could do lots of things, don't really know what I want to do. It's a good holding pattern. And I enrolled in my law degree. It was never an inevitability. And it was really, I just sort of fell into law at that stage of my life.
My daughter is followed similar pattern to you, eventually going into the law, but it's a very intense study at the tertiary level before you get your qualification, and it requires unbelievable amounts of research and reading and understanding all the processes and the history of the law. What did you learn about the history of the law as we practice it in what was called British justice?
Well, and I was learning the law in a very peculiar form of British justice. I'm a Queenslander. So I was doing law at UQ. I don't shy away from hard work. I really enjoyed the law. But I also realised how naive I was and how much I didn't understand the way in which government operates in Australia, in Queensland, and I didn't understand the history. And so what I ended up doing very quickly is I was doing a science law degree, a double degree at UQ, and I ended up dropping my science. You know, all those goals of being a vet were now behind me. And I picked up journalism, and I did a journalism law degree. And I really picked up journalism because I wanted to better understand that history of Queensland. The Fitzgerald Inquiry, the corruption of the police force, of the government, implicating judges, implicating a whole lot of people. And the journalism course at UQ at the time was just excellent in relation to that. And I found that combination of journalism and law gave me that better understanding of the context, the contingency of law, the contingency of democracy, the contingency of good government.
So you lived through and observed the Fitzgerald Inquiry in the late 1980s.
Oh, well, I was quite young during the Fitzgerald Inquiry. I do remember the Fitzgerald Inquiry. I do remember the Goss Labor government win when I was quite young. But when I was at university, the unpicking and the sort of working out the implications for what type of governance regulatory framework was going to be required in a state like Queensland that had come through the corruption scandals of the Fitzgerald Inquiry was really quite formative for me.
What did you understand by the separation of powers?
Well, I feel like I'm in the dock, Quentin.
This is a cross-examination. As Janet Ulrichsen says, it's the engine room of the truth.
Yes, I mean all of that. And, you know, what was interesting is when I graduated from law school, I did a year as an associate on the Supreme Court of Queensland. And my judge was Justice Phil McMurdo. I learned so much from him and his wife, Margaret McMurdo, who was the president of the Court of Appeal. And seeing how they conducted themselves, the independence of the judiciary, but then also when there was threats to the independence of the judiciary in subsequent years in Queensland, how they continued to conduct themselves and spoke out, and the need for them to speak out, given the history of corruption in Queensland. I was just always impressed by the strength and courage of bravery of those people who'd lived through those years and then continued to be guardians of the separation of powers and judicial independence. Really left an impression.
It sounds as though you got a pretty good insight into the collegiality of the judicial officers in Queensland in particular, which goes to the independence of the judiciary, which goes to the separation of powers from the executive and the parliament.
Yes, absolutely. And that time as a judge's associate, you know, being a fly on the wall in so many conversations and understanding how important it is for the functioning of the system, that personal integrity and that collegiate integrity is, you know, I always recommend it to my law students if it's a possibility. It's a real insight that you can get from that position.
How I was always worried, and because you had those insights from your experience as a judge's associate, about the stacking of the judiciary, particularly now with concerns in Trump's the United States about the stacking of the US Supreme Court, how do we mitigate against politicians who ultimately have the power of appointment of judicial officers? How do we mitigate the stack?
Yeah, well, it continues to be a potential problem in Australia. It has arisen more acutely at various times. You know, the power of judicial appointment across Australia remains the gift of the executive. And so that potential for abuse of that power exists. There are protocols that have been put in place in a number of jurisdictions that require an independent panel to make recommendations to the executive, a set of criteria. But I've long advocated that we need a better legislative framework around that, that actually cements that, puts it in place to make sure that that gift of the executive, judicial appointment, is not abused. We know how important judicial power is. We know how important it is in reining in the executive and overseeing the executive, overseeing parliament. And there is always the potential there. And it's something that I've spent quite a lot of my career campaigning for. We're not there yet, but that's the case with many integrity reforms. I always say to people in relation to this, and in many integrity reforms, actually, it's not that we don't know what the solution is. It's that we now have to do the advocacy work to get the political will to put the solution in place.
It's been my observation that when it comes to judicial appointments, and I'm sorry to, I'll get back to you shortly, but with the judicial appointments that the Attorney General of the states and federally talks to the Chief Justice, the Bar Association, the Law Council, and the various other, shall we say, stakeholders in the administration of justice in Australia, and says, oh, I've got this list of people for judicial appointment. Do you see any red flags with them? And it's all done behind closed doors. It's not like the US system of nominations in public and hearings in public. It's all done behind closed doors. But overall, I think in the history of Australia since Federation, it's been pretty sound, hasn't it?
Yeah, so I would say that overall Australia has been very well served by its judiciary, and that reflects on the judicial appointments. That's not to say there haven't been instances where there's been controversy, sometimes very public controversy over appointments that have...
There have been a few duds.
And the challenge is, you know, a dud judicial appointment, particularly a senior judicial appointment, can really bring up issues of public trust in the judiciary. Once you start getting there, then the whole system starts to break down. Whilst by and large, we've been very well served, I think that it doesn't undermine the need for reform. And of course, it goes to trust as well, that lack of transparency. Not that I would be advocating for the American system. There is definitely other alternatives. But that lack of transparency just brings with it the whiff of a lack of integrity. Why not a more transparent process in which those consultations and the criteria against which people are appointed, why isn't that more public? What are people hiding?
Exactly. And I'm pleased to see that you're campaigning on that. And you, from you developed from these observations as a judge's associate, didn't you? So then what happened with your career?
So when I first went into practice, I spent most of my time working for the government. I was a government lawyer for both the Queensland Crown Law, Queensland government, and then for the Victorian Government Solicitor's Office. Working first as an article clerk in Queensland for the team that supported the Solicitor General. So the Solicitor General being the top lawyer in the government, and at the time in Queensland that was Patrick Keane, QC, who went on to be appointed to the High Court. They were really important years for me as well. I learned a lot from Pat. He had a very interesting philosophy in relation to the role of the judge, the role of government. He really believed in the importance of political accountability. He believed in democracy. Yes, the judges had a role, but that was to support political accountability, to support democracy. This theory of judging versus political accountability was quite formative for me. It wasn't that I disagreed with it, but I came to realise that the theory only works if democracy works. So if you're going to put a whole lot of trust in the people holding the government to account for bad decisions, the people holding the government to account for abuses of rights and these types of things, the democracy needs to work and it needs to reflect the views of the people, and it can't just be sort of base majoritarian democracy either. It needs to be more inclusive. So this sort of was also really important in me understanding where I sat in terms of what I thought the role for the courts were. Very important. Judicial independence, obviously very important. But where that sat vis-a-vis democracy and the role of the people checking government.
When did you start publishing?
Oh, that's a good question. The first piece I published was a piece that came out of my master's thesis at University of Melbourne, and it was called There Must Be Limits, the Commonwealth Executive Spending Power, in which I talked about the abuse of Commonwealth government's expenditures and how there really needed to be more enforceable, judicially enforceable limits on that, and that the political accountability of government spending, in my view, at that time, this was back in 2007, was insufficient. And it was wonderful because I was vindicated in that less than a year when the High Court handed down a big decision in which they found limits to the Commonwealth spending power.
So that was my first piece. You stuck your neck out.
I did. I mean, not that I don't think that I influence the High Court in any way.
It's properly researched, of course, but nevertheless, you did a substantiated piece and with research and what, case history?
Yeah, so it was both informed by doctrine, so it was very sort of heavy black letter piece, but it was also informed by the practice of government spending and the lack of political accountability for what we would call sort of pork barreling or rorts in relation to government grants, particularly around election time. And I was supervised in that thesis by Professor Cheryl Saunders at the University of Melbourne. And she, you know, she's one of Australia's leading constitutional lawyers, and was really encouraging me to do this piece that was focused on a current problem that I saw in government, not just a highly theoretical piece. And that's really kind of been a driving force for my academic career since, in that I am focused on real problems that I see in the government and political domain. The research is done, it's rigorous, it's legal, it's qualitative where needed, but it is focused on a real world problem.
It sounds as though you are also subjected to what many people suffer in Australia, and that is deep cynicism. Did you become cynical with what you saw as you did your research about the way politics is practiced in our country?
Yes, I mean, I don't think I was necessarily ever not cynical, though. As I said, I grew up, my dad was a public servant. He was eventually a director in the Brisbane City Council, which is a very large local government, and served different mayors and was subjected to different political pressures as a public servant. So I was sort of aware of that, just sort of from around the kitchen table. And of course, as I said, learning about the Fitzgerald Inquiry and the sort of political context of my state of Queensland, I think I started cynical and then realised that, well, yes, but you can also, you can either just be cynical and throw your hands up, or you can be cynical and say, well, how do we fix it? Yeah. And that's where I really sort of thought, well, I can put my shoulder to the wheel here and can work towards solutions to this. Not that democracy will ever be perfectly practiced, so I'm not that naive, but there are solutions to a lot of the issues that we see.
And after you felt vindicated by the High Court decision in that case, after the publication of your first paper, that must have been confidence building and a real sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, it is. It is, I think. I think being able to think that you've contributed in some small way to a change that you think is going to result in better government for all people, I think that there is a level of satisfaction about that. It's why you keep coming back. It's why you keep pushing. It's not to say that I think the vindication doesn't happen as often as I would like. There's not as many wins as I would like, but the wins you do have are important and they keep you going. And you learn as well. You learn from different wins and different ways. And, you know, who are you targeting? Do you want the courts and the judges to develop doctrine, develop the law in a particular way? Is it a political target? Are you looking for legislative reform, policy reform, cultural reform? You learn from each of those wins, you learn from each of the losses, and then you adjust the way in which you do your research, you do your advocacy accordingly.
Okay, what came next after the first publication? Just briefly take us through the various focus items and research projects you took on.
So my next big project was I did the PhD. So that was as a baby academic, I'd done a master's thesis, and I thought, no, I really like this academia stuff. The High Court's following my lead. No, I'm kidding there, of course. But I decided I wanted to be an academic, and so I needed to do a PhD. That was the advice that I was given the man who eventually became my supervisor, Professor John Williams at the University of Adelaide. And I ended up doing my PhD on a topic that someone once said to me, oh, gee, this has got to be the most boring topic in the world. I did my PhD on the role of the Solicitor General. So the role of government lawyers. What is the role of government lawyers, and particularly this top lawyer, the Solicitor General? It was a doctrinal PhD. I looked at the law around it, the practice of it, and then I interviewed a whole lot of Solicitors General. And it was great fun. It was great fun. It was really insightful about what it is about government lawyers that's different from private lawyers, what it is about working for the government, this entity with obligations to the public. When you're a lawyer for the government, what do you need to do differently? And it was well received. It became published. It got some really lovely book reviews. And then it sort of sat in abeyance for a while until of course, the Robo-Debt Royal Commission. And one of the key findings of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission was the failures of government lawyers in relation to that scheme and the ethical responsibilities of government lawyers. And suddenly, people were interested again. So this work that I'd done years ago became really topical again, and it's been really fulfilling, actually, pulling it out and having a look and being able to talk about, yeah, where were the failures and what should a good government lawyer be aspiring to, and what type of structures and support do we need to put in place for government lawyers?
Wow.
That's
wonderful, Gabrielle. But the Solicitor General has been an entity, a statutory entity within Westminster system right through the British Westminster system, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So the Solicitor General, along with the Attorney General, so the first and second law officers, they were sort of inherited into Australia in the colonial government. But Australia's always done things quite differently. That's because initially we were colonies, we were penal colonies, we're very small. The Attorney General, right from the get-go, was a very political officer sitting in the Executive Council, what became Cabinet. And the Solicitor General evolved to be this sort of more professional, supportive legal officer, the legal expert in the government, which is different from the UK, in which both the Attorney and the Solicitor General perform a more aloof role. So Australia has its own system. And I've actually gone to the UK and said, well, maybe the UK should learn from how Australia does it as well. So there's a bit of cross-fertilisation there.
But just explain to me, Gabrielle, is the Solicitor General in Australia demonstrably independent, or does he or she take his or her instructions from the government of the day?
That's a good question. And of course, they're a lawyer. They act on instructions. That is, they respond to instructions in terms of requests for advice. They respond to instructions in terms of what cases to pursue and arguments to put. But they also have professional obligations in terms of how they exercise their, how they sort of provide their advice, exercise their discretion, make judgment calls about whether something is legal, is not legal, what's arguable, what's not arguable. So they have, like any lawyer, professional obligations to the law and to the court. And I also have argued for a long time that as government lawyers, they have an additional layer of obligations, which is this idea to the government as a whole and the public interest and advising the government on higher level constitutional principle. You know, they're advisors, they're not actors, but they should be providing this advice to government.
And what was revealed from the Robo-Debt Royal Commission about the strengths and weaknesses of the Commonwealth Solicitor General in the context of advice to government about robo-debt?
So the Commonwealth Solicitor General's advice in robo-debt was sought very late in the day, years after the issues were sort of known about within the department. And of course, once the Solicitor General advised, that did put an end to the robo-debt scheme. But prior to that, there had been advice, insufficient advice, sometimes no advice by internal government lawyers within the departments. And so what it revealed is, well, how much support is being provided to those internal government lawyers in terms of supporting their professional obligations, not just their obligation to the government department? Are departments seeking advice when they need to? Are they escalating advice to the Solicitor General when they should, or to more senior government lawyers when they should? Particularly escalating it outside of the in-house legal advice. So there's a whole lot of sort of structural stuff below the Solicitor General that does impact on the Solicitor General, but tells us a lot about the day-to-day advice that's given by the government lawyers that sit within departments.
That's good to know. Have you written this up after the Robo-Debt Royal Commission exposed the what was the not the failure of the Solicitor General so much, but the need for the Solicitor General and the resources of the government solicitor general to go into almost preemptive advice to government when it's going to do something which is highly questionable. Everything's justiciable, of course, in a democracy and a judicial system. But have you written this up?
Yeah, so I do have I've spoken at a lot of events, and I have a piece in the Australian Administrative Law Journal on the implications for government lawyers of robo-debt. But I think also, even more importantly than the piece I've written, I've talked to a lot of people within the different structures that support government lawyers at the Commonwealth level, and they've done a lot of work since robo-debt in relation to supporting government lawyers, in supporting in-house government lawyers, and providing greater guidance about how to advise on risk and greater guidance about when to escalate issues, legal issues. And so I've worked with those people and organisations within the government itself to try to actually address these problems. Once again, it's important to do the academic work and all the research, but I also feel like it's important to make sure you're trying to get change to deal with the issues that you've identified.
So an incoming Solicitor General or anybody contemplating appointment to a Solicitor General, state or federal or territory, should be able to look at this work and take the educational benefit from it, so that they say, I have a red flag duty to advise government that this is dangerous and illegal, for example, because we've got a body of work now and a case history of what was known, robo-debt, as one of the biggest Commonwealth government implementation failures since Federation.
Yeah, look, yes, there is quite a lot. I mean, the Royal Commission report itself is pretty important reading, I think, for anyone coming into the role. But certainly I've written on it, and it draws a lot on the book as well, the my PhD thesis. And it has been nice speaking to Solicitors General that have come into the role. They always do say that they read the book with great interest. They learn a lot coming into the position, that it's very helpful for them, that all exists there. The body of work exists for those coming into these issues.
Gabrielle, tell us about your family life and how that's helped you in this very difficult and intellectually stimulating but challenging work that you do. You've got a family life, I understand.
I do. The juggle is real. I have a wonderful family. My partner, who works in international climate philanthropy, so he's very busy and very motivated work. And then we've got two children, a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. I've just come back from my second time in maternity leave, which, you know, has been a really grounding experience for me. It's both meant that I can't do as much because I don't have as much time that I can just dedicate to work. But it has meant, I think, that I've been more selective about what I am doing, making sure it really is the work that's going to make a difference. And in that respect, I've really ramped up the work that I've been doing with the Centre for Public Integrity. I really believe this is important work. And it's of course made me more efficient when I am at work. And I think just sort of sharpens the problem for you. You know, when I was younger, this idea, I wanted to make democracy function better. I wanted to make government as best it could be for the people. And now I have my people, I have my kids. And so when I'm talking about making sure that democracy is functioning as well as it can in Australia, it's for their future. They're going to be the people of the future that these governments govern for. So that's certainly been an important part of my work in the last few years to sharpen the reasons I do what I do.
Can you tell us what your role was in the great referendum of 2 years ago on the what was called the Voice, but the constitutional recognition of dispossession of First Nations people.
Yeah, I mean, this was probably one of the hardest times of my academic career, my professional career, and also just my personal life. When I started at University of New South Wales, where I'm still a professor, I became very good friends very quickly with a wonderful woman, Professor Megan Davis, Aboriginal constitutional lawyer, expert in Indigenous rights. And at that time, she was in the thick of designing what became known as the Regional Dialogues and the First Nations Constitutional Convention that ultimately delivered the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Now, as I said, I became very good friends with Megan. And then I received a text message from her one, I think it was a Wednesday. And she said, "What are you doing this weekend?" And I was like, "Well, I was going to go for a bike ride, you know, do all these things that a single person does when they've got lots of time on their hands." And she said, "We need you in Melbourne." And that was the start. I became an advisor, a constitutional specialist advisor to the regional dialogues, assisting the leadership. So Megan Davis, Arnie Pat Anderson, Noel Pearson and others, but more importantly, the delegates, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who deliberated about what type of change and constitutional recognition that they wanted to seek from the Australian people. So that was back in 2017, and I was at all of the regional dialogues, bar one. I was at the convention advising the delegates again. And then after the delivery of the Uluru Statement, continued to work and advise First Nations leaders about how to deliver that reform of a First Nations voice, an institution that was going to provide an authoritative, representative voice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people into government, into parliament, about decisions that affect them. Now, I really believed and still believe in that reform for a number of reasons. The deliberative process that was undertaken was just phenomenal. The hard work of those delegates was just amazing. It was clear that this was a reform that they believed was going to speak to their issues of voicelessness and powerlessness. But also from my own experience working in government, in democracy, I could see that this was a reform that would work and that it would cut through some of the problems of ballot box democracy for minority, vulnerable, historically persecuted groups like Aboriginal people in Australia. So I really believed in this reform. I worked with First Nations leaders to develop the reform and then campaigned with them during the referendum. So it was both, it ran in parallel to some of the work I've been doing for the Centre for Public Integrity, but I do see them very much entwined. As I say, it's about making democracy function better, more inclusively for people, particularly people who've been marginalised by it in the past. The defeat at the referendum in 2023 was devastating, particularly for those First Nations people that I've been working with for years, and itself a failure of democracy in my view in many ways, in that how the campaign was run was very distorted. But I don't think that the fight's over yet. We're learning. And I'm sure that it's not the last that we'll hear about this reform.
Well, I'm pleased to see that you're psychologically tough, Gabrielle, because it was devastating to all the constitutional lawyers of Australia who supported the simple version of the voice as an advisory body to the federal parliament. But at the same time, enshrining in the constitution the lessons from Mabo, the High Court decision, which overruled Terra Nullius, which was from the British Crown, on the settlement of Australia by the colonists in 1788. But I know you want to keep going on about that, but what did you learn? My view was that Albanese should never have put up the referendum without getting Dutton and Littleproud and the leaders to develop bipartisanship. It was too dangerous given the well-known history of the failure of referenda in Australia if there isn't bipartisanship. Would you agree with that? You were hoping, I'm sure, everybody who supported the referendum question being carried, everybody was hoping that that could be overcome. But didn't it it fall at the first hurdle?
So I think that the lack of bipartisanship is was obviously an important dimension to the referendum loss. I think it's possibly too easy to simply say that the lack of bipartisanship is the reason the referendum failed. I think a lot of the way in which the campaign unfolded what could have been anticipated and was anticipated, but the Albanese government didn't put in place the types of regulation of the campaign that were being urged upon them, right? You know, I worked with a political scientist, Professor Lisa Hill, to urge upon them truth in political advertising legislation prior to the campaign. I worked with other deliberative democracy experts and Professor Megan Davis to urge upon them the need for a citizens' assembly, so more public participation very early on in the campaign. And I worked with referendum experts, people like Associate Professor Paul Kildea, who's one of the leading referendum experts, to urge upon the government to put in place some sort of authoritative expert fact-checking in relation to assertions in the referendum campaign. Yes, lack of bipartisanship was an important factor, but the way in which the campaign unfolded, particularly key spokespeople for the No campaign, those who were associated with the opposition, that was all anticipated. And there were ways in which that could have been, I'm not going to say countered entirely, regulated in a way that the Australian people would have had a fairer idea about what the proposal was and what it wasn't. As you say, it was a relatively modest proposal, but one that was definitely directed at making a difference for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's lives.
One of the biggest challenges from what you've just said emerges about current contemporary practice of politics, where all the greatest constitutional experts, the broad, wide consensus of lawyers in our country can be overridden by what's known as misinformation and disinformation. That is a great confrontation for a functioning democracy, is it not?
It's enormous. I think it is probably one of the biggest challenges that we are facing. We're about to come into a major federal election. We'll see how it plays out there. I think that what we saw during the Voice referendum, so the active use of disinformation, information that people know is untrue or decontextualized in such a way that it's sensational and doesn't provide the full story. And then the way in which social media is able to replicate that, and even people who might just be innocently are sharing that misinformation now, sort of without that malicious intent. You know, we saw it during the referendum at a level that we'd not seen it before in Australia. I think we'll see it again during this federal election campaign. And how to regulate that, I don't think there's a single solution. How to regulate that. There's a whole lot of complex stuff going on there. Regulation of social media, regulation of truth in political advertising, regulation of foreign interference, regulation of AI and bots. It's a multi-pronged a solution that's needed, but that to me is one of the key issues that democracy is facing right now.
I'm glad you're shaping up to it, because what you've just said does indicate a major research and effort and advocacy project ahead for people like you and the Centre for Public Integrity. Just briefly, Gabriel, tell us about your work for the Centre for Public Integrity. What have been your particular achievements you've been proud of?
Yeah, look, so I've been a director for the centre for a couple of years now, but I've been working on the expert committees for the centre since 2020. And I came on board in 2020 just as the lockdowns were starting during COVID, with a real concern about executive lawmaking and the delegation of power by the parliament to the executive to deal with this crisis, this emergency. And the infringement on rights and liberties that were being imposed without proper checks and balances. I worked for a number of years with CPI on that. And some of the changes that the centre was able to get, particularly in Victoria, where some of the lockdowns hit the hardest, you know, there's now pandemic-specific legislation to deal with emergencies in Victoria in ways where there is much greater scrutiny. So very proud of that work. Going back to my master's thesis, my first ever published piece of work, the need to bring government expenditure to account. I've been working with the Centre for Public Integrity to try to develop a whole new framework for Commonwealth grants to really get at this issue of pork barrelling and have greater transparency and accountability for those grants. Now, we're not there yet. That remains an issue, but I'm proud of the work that's been done, and I'm proud that CPI's got its teeth in it and it's not going to let it go. And I look forward to successes in that in the future.
What about the National Anti-Corruption Commission, which the centre had campaigned for so long?
Yeah, look, I wasn't involved in that campaign, but you know, it's an incredible mark of the impact that the centre has had. When the centre first started campaigning for it, there was bipartisan opposition to the idea. Commonwealth governments of all persuasions had said, no, we don't need an anti-corruption commission. I think what we're seeing now, not just at the national level, but across the states and territories, is a real need for institutions like CPI to keep their teeth in it, because it's one thing to have an anti-corruption commission. It's another thing to have a well-functioning anti-corruption commission that's doing its job well. It's only through well-funded, properly appointed, with the right scope of jurisdiction that you're going to get the outcomes that you need.
Exactly. What I've learned from this discussion is that democracies can only function effectively if there is public trust in the institutions of the democracy, and that can't be taken for granted anymore. So you've got a lot of work to do still, Gabriel. I'm so delighted that you're still motivated and courageous enough.
The point you make is the right one. Democracies will never be perfect, and the job will never be done about ensuring integrity. We've got to keep our teeth in it.
Professor Gabriel Appleby, thanks very much for talking to us, and keep up the good work.